Hello, everyone, and thanks for turning on The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, security services in the North Caucasus region of Ingushetia are accused of systematically violating human rights in the fight against militants.
A person can be suspected today and easily killed tomorrow, and his house burned down. If the security services had any real proof, they'd go through the courts.
And a newly uncovered intelligence agency dossier says Vladimir Putin was a womanizing wife beater when he worked as a spy in East Germany. Our correspondent talks about the reaction to the story in Russia.
If you think about Monica Lewinsky case, it was devastating for Clinton and the United States. It boosted his popularity in Russia.
But first, the provocative question, where do jihadists come from? That's the title of a talk I attended that was given by Saranan Dume. The veteran journalist is the author of My Friend the Fanatic Travels with a Radical Islamist. It's a travel narrative about the rise of fundamentalism in Indonesia. He joins me now in our Prague studio. I'd like to talk about the wider issues of radical and militant Islam around the world, but could you start by giving me some background on your book? What were some key insights that you picked up?
Yeah, My Friend the Fanatic is a kind of political travelogue. So it's a political travelogue come memoir. At one level, it's the story of my friendship with a young Indonesian radical, Harry Nordi, who was the managing editor of a fundamentalist magazine called Sabili. And another level, it's a story of the political evolution of the world's most populous country, Indonesia. And it talks about how this idea of radical Islam, which was quite alien to Indonesia's traditional form of Islam, it began to take root in the 1970s, gathered steam in the 80s, but really had its sort of full flowering in the late 90s after the fall of the Suharto dictatorship. And it sort of traces this idea in what would seem to be, on the face of it, a very inhospitable ground, but which turned out to be not such inhospitable ground.
Well, in Indonesia in particular, what's the connection between radical Islam and political Islam? And is there a trend moving in a certain direction in those relationships?
I mean, I use them as synonyms, really. I mean, I think that there is room for debate and disagreement over here. Some people would argue that radical Islam is only radical if it uses violent means. That's not how I see it. I think it's radical Islam if it pursues totalitarian ends. So if what you're aiming for is a society which is monolithic, a society where people of other faiths do not enjoy equal rights, a society where women are discouraged from practicing politics or from having leadership positions, a society which does not recognize free speech as we recognize it currently in other parts of the world, that to me in itself is radical Islam. And of course it's better if you're pursuing those goals by the ballot rather than the bullet, but I don't distinguish between radical Islam and what you call political Islam in terms of methods. I think that sort of the methods are important, but they're not as important as the goals. And so for me, they are essentially synonyms.
Well, radical Islam in Indonesia is not a particularly violent form as opposed to Pakistan or other countries in the Middle East. What accounts for the differences in the levels of violence utilized by radical Islamists in Indonesia as opposed to, let's say, Pakistan?
That's a very good question. I think the level of violence is largely explained by the will of the state to act against violent radical Islamists. So what you've seen in places in Indonesia was that even though there was a great degree of tolerance for radical Islamic political ideas, there's very little tolerance for radical Islamist terrorism. And the Indonesian government acted with great decisiveness and great organization in shutting down Jamaah Islamiyah, the group that was responsible for the Bali bombings. And it showed that political will, despite the fact that Jamaah Islamiyah had political supporters among radical Islamist politicians, but those political supporters didn't have the clout to stop the government from cracking down on them. In Pakistan, it's been a very different situation where the government has really been of two minds about whether it should crack down or not. And by and large, the government of Pakistan has tried to make this distinction, which I think is too clever by half, a distinction between good radicals and bad radicals, tried to go after some, tried to not go after the others because they're trying to maybe using them as proxies, whether in Afghanistan or whether in parts of India. And that's the fundamental difference, that lack of government will, this failure to understand that it's a problem when someone uses violence to pursue these goals, regardless of whether you can use those guys to forward your own goals outside your borders.
Now, there's a common perception that radical Islam and violent Islam is driven by political suppression, by poverty. I'm not sure you agree with that issue. Could you explain what you think the driving forces are, why you think that those aren't the main factors?
Well, I think that I would look at those two things that you mentioned, political oppression and poverty. Right? I think on poverty, the evidence is overwhelming that there's no connection. Poverty does not drive radical Islam. In fact, I think it's absurd. There's a very, very long list of extremely privileged, wealthy radical Islamists, starting with Osama bin Laden, going on to Ayman al-Zawahiri, and so on. So the poverty idea actually is completely preposterous, and it shows a kind of blindness to the facts, and it shows a need to interpret reality in terms that are, frankly, completely out of touch with what's happening on the ground. Political oppression, I have more patience with that idea, because I think that in some countries, it is true that dissent that would otherwise perhaps have found secular expression was channeled towards the mosque and towards radical Islam. So I think that there has been an interplay where authoritarianism has helped Islamism by giving it the aura of resistance. That said, I think the ideas stand on their own, and you must take the ideas seriously, because the ideas are attractive. They are attractive even to people who have not experienced oppression, even to people who have not experienced poverty, even to people who have no possible reason to bear a grudge against U.S. foreign policy or Israel or whatever other excuses they trot out. So the ideas exist in and of themselves, and they have a certain explanatory power, and that's what drives it more than anything else.
Do you think that the West overreacts to violent radical Islam?
No, I don't think the West overreacts to violent radical Islam. I think the Western reaction has been measured. I think the Western reaction has the West has sought to understand it, and I think correctly has recognized that a certain amount of force is going to be necessary in dealing with the most violent elements.
You also spoke about earlier the best antidote to radical Islam taking over as a form of government, Sharia law being imposed. Could you explain what you meant by that?
Well, I think that there are the biggest antidote, really, are the lessons learned by people who have actually lived under radical Islam, whether it's people who've lived under the theocracy of Iran or whether it's people who've lived under the barbarism of the Taliban. These people have no desire to go back to that, because they've seen what these utopian ideas, like any kind of utopianism, they've seen the kind of violence and the kind of nihilism that this ideology, in fact, imposes on people it governs. And so those are the people who I think have, in some ways, their stories, the stories of their suffering, the stories of what they learned living under this, ought to be heard widely, to give other people who have not had that experience to sort of make them a little bit less starry-eyed about the promises that radical Islamists tend to make.
Is there a less radical antidote?
Yes, I think that there are. I think that there are ideas that need to be propagated in opposition to it. I think in the end, this is a battle of ideas, and I think you can find good ideas opposed to radical Islam both from within the Muslim tradition. So, for example, you can look to Sufism and other more traditional forms of Islam that are opposed to radical Islam. But also more broadly, I don't think people should be shy of bringing in debates that exist in the West or elsewhere. I think very often in the West we're a little bit too defensive about our own ideas, and I think there's no reason for us to be defensive about them. I think that ideas are good or bad or can be judged simply as ideas, and there's no reason to be defensive, for example, about democracy or about the Enlightenment or about other ideas that may have been born in the West but have been adapted perfectly reasonably in many other countries, including Japan and Korea and India. And there's no reason why we should be shy about exposing Muslim populations to those very same ideas of human progress.
But just to be clear, in the end, you're not opposed to Islamic forms of government, just radical Islamic forms of government, or what? Can you make the distinction?
Well, I don't think we should get. The danger with that is that we could end up splitting hairs. I am opposed to any government that seeks to impose impose Sharia on society and the state. I don't think it has been done anywhere in the world. Whether you look at Sudan or Afghanistan or Iran, there is no place in the world that it has been done without causing great damage to local Muslim populations, to non-Muslim minorities and women, and we should be very clear that this is not something desirable.
That was Sadanan Dume, a columnist for The Wall Street Journal, a resident fellow with the American Enterprise Institute, and the author of My Friend the Fanatic, Travels with a Radical Islamist.
Radio Fado,
Radio Svoboda.
Azadytsyun GTM.
In the North Caucasus, the region of Ingushetia is plagued by violent militants. But human rights groups say security forces are reacting with lawless violence of their own. Correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer reports that even the region's popular leader has been unable to tackle the root causes of violence there.
The hills around Nazran, the main town in Russia's Caucasus Mountains region of Ingushetia, may appear peaceful, but many here live in fear. Last May, masked gunmen in uniform abducted Maka Porsheva's son. She hasn't seen him since.
I can't come up with a reason. He was very well behaved from childhood. He never lied or stole. The only thing people may not have liked was his piousness. He was a very devout boy.
Such stories characterize daily life in Ingushetia. Prime Minister Vladimir Putin has claimed credit for increasing stability in this volatile region. But as he prepares for an almost certain return to the presidency next year, people here say they're very worried about the future. Porsheva says her son was a hard worker who loved his two small children. She insists there are laws in this country.
If he's guilty, let them punish him. But tell me, whether my child is still alive? That's all I ask.
But despite the violence, Ingushetia stands out in the North Caucasus for its leader, Yunus Bek Yevkurov, who says his main task is to make clear to officials that everything we do is for the people.
We're in power thanks to them. Without the people, there'll be no bureaucrats. But although I'm trying to reduce the problems in the region, people have to understand that we can't do everything.
Yevkurov is genuinely popular for prevailing on the security forces searching for Islamist militants to reduce house searches and arrests, and for building schools and talking to human rights activists and ordinary people. But he also says it's parents' responsibility to know what their children are doing. He says they shouldn't be surprised when their sons are targeted in security operations against known militants.
Every single time they tell me, we didn't see anything. When I ask them, but did you know your children were meeting militants in the forest? They say, no, they didn't know.
But such accusations anger those who believe many young men disappear only because of the slightest suspicion they know a militant. Abubakar Sechayev of the leading human rights group, Memorial.
A person can be suspected today and easily killed tomorrow, and his house burned down. If the security services had any real proof, they'd go through the courts.
Sechayev's memorial colleague Ahmet Barakhoev says the real problem is Yevkurov's powerlessness to tackle the root causes of the constant violence that has come to characterize the region.
Yevkurov and others in the administration can't influence the situation in the Caucasus today because much of what's going on is dictated by security structures that aren't subordinate to him or anyone else inside the region.
50 kilometers west of Nazran, the town of Malgabiek is relatively prosperous and well-kept. Still, a day earlier, security forces swooped in to arrest six young men they say had come down from the mountains to plan militant attacks. After one resident of a nearby village protested when troops broke into her house, she was told, "We do whatever we want here." But near Nazran, Zarema Deligova, a French teacher at the local university, says violence is only part of the problem.
If corruption is the main woe elsewhere in Russia, here it's corruption and the military. I don't know which is worse.
Despite President Yevkurov's efforts, residents say official corruption is choking the economy, fueling a staggering unemployment rate of 57%. Locals say that makes it even easier for militants to attract jobless new recruits who are already inclined to take up arms to seek revenge against the security services.
That was correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer reporting from Ingushetia.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
A lot has been said about Vladimir Putin, the leader, but what about Putin, the husband? Western journalists have been riveted by recent allegations from a German foreign intelligence expert. He said he found evidence that the former and future Russian president beat and cheated on his wife while serving as a KGB operative in East Germany. Daisy Sindelar spoke to Russian service correspondent Irina Lagunina about what the story says about the Putins and the state of marriage in Russia.
We're looking at recent revelations by Eric Schmidt-Einbohm, a German journalist who has written extensively on Germany's foreign intelligence agency, the BND, about some rather unflattering aspects of Vladimir Putin's personal life while he was a KGB operative in the East German city of Dresden in the 1980s. Schmidt-Einbohm claims to have evidence that Putin's household was effectively infiltrated by a young female agent who went by the name of Lenchen or Lenechka, and she was a Baltic German who spoke German and Russian with equal fluency, and she was posing as a translator with the KGB bureau in Dresden. But Lenechka soon became friends with Putin's wife, Ludmila, and began to hear some rather scandalous things about the state of the Putin's marriage. Schmidt-Einbohm spoke to your Russian service colleague Alexander Mannheim. So let's listen to a little of what he had to say.
The task of this agent was to supply information about the KGB's activities in Germany, primarily in the south, and to collect military and economic data. But she quickly made friends with Ludmila Putina and became a kind of trusted confidant for her, almost a soulmate. And Ludmila told her that Vladimir frequently beat her and cheated on her, and that he had liaisons with other women.
So, a lot of European newspapers have really gone to town with this story. Is it getting a lot of attention in Russia?
It is getting some attention in the blogs, and strangely enough, I did not see that much discussion of this in Facebook. But probably because this is something that is not a complete revelation because Putin's behavior recently was surrounded by rumors of his affairs with different sports ladies or whatever. So one of the Russian journalists, Trigubova, wrote in her book how Putin flirted with her and how he invited her to restaurants, sushi restaurant, actually. And so it's not something completely new. But yes, it is revealing, and I think it's very much revealing the nature of the society, both this information, if true, and the reaction of Russian society to this.
Well, Ludmila Putina is one of those, presidential wives. She will again be a presidential wife, but a political wife who isn't always in the public eye, and she's seen as being sort of shy and reclusive. And I don't think anyone who has even a casual acquaintance with their marriage would describe it as a romantic or affectionate one. They seem quite distant from each other. But there's a big difference between having a cold marriage and having a marriage that involves violence, adultery. And does that cause any kind of uproar in Russia, or is that considered par for the course?
Well, let me tell you that the most comprehensive study of what's going on in Russian families was made by Amnesty International in 2005. And what this study found out was that 70% of married women in Russia experienced in their life some sort of domestic violence, not necessarily physical, but sexual or psychological. 70%, this is an awful figure, I think. In 2003, there was also a study made of how many women died from the domestic violence. If you can imagine then that in Russia, with a population of 142 million people, 9,000 women died from domestic violence. I think this is very revealing. This is, and this is official statistics, but once again, all these centers of, there are centers for help to, there are centers that help those women, the victims of domestic violence, of course. So according to their data, yes, women do complain. They go to the police and then they complain about what happened. But then up to 90% of these complaints are withdrawn by the same women. So statistics do not reflect the real problem in Russia, the real scale of domestic violence. So this is probably why this information about inside, alleged information about inside of Putin's family life was not something shocking for the society. And by the way, the climate of the society is so that if you think about, Monica Lewinsky case and Clinton, it was devastating for Clinton in the United States. It boosted his popularity in Russia. I mean, he gained so many points just for the fact that probably he had an affair with Monica Lewinsky.
Our producer behind the glasses is laughing at that story, but it brings up an interesting point, because I think one of the things that's really fascinating about this story for audiences in the West is that these allegations have the potential to sink the career of a politician, or at the very least deeply damage it, of a politician in the West, particularly in the United States. And of course, right now, as you know, the Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain is fighting off allegations that he sexually harassed two women who have come out and publicly accused him. And this isn't beating and adultery. This is inappropriate touching. And yet he is widely expected to pull out of the race, and this will be the end of his presidential career. Putin, as we know, is soon to step down from being prime minister and resume his desired post as president of Russia. Is there any likelihood that this is going to have put any kind of black mark on his reputation as a national leader?
No, not at all. You know, there is a Russian saying, if he beats, he respects. I don't know why it is, but that is the picture of the relationship in the family. So for the traditional Russian families, traditional Russian society, and when I use traditional, I use it in a negative sense right now. For the traditional Russian family, beating means respect. of wife. So no, there will be no black mark. And plus, you know, the whole atmosphere in Russia right now is very deeply sexist. The main TV channels, and you know that all the TV channels are state-owned in Russia, the TV channels portray women either as prostitute, as those who want to or are willing to sell themselves for money and well-being. They portray violence against women. There are pretty much violent, serious criminal series going on all the time that I find disgusting, but that's how the society is brought up. And respect for women and respect for the role of women in this society is very much a propaganda tool right now in order to boost birth rate in Russia. And it's shocking how, how two things, the sexism in the society on one hand and this propaganda, oh, we want more kids to be born so that the Russian nation would not disappear at all, how they actually visually contradict each other. You see this crime and scenes of violence on TV. And on the other hand, you go into Moscow metro and you see this huge poster which reflects the Russian, the Soviet-type images of women. We call it blood and milk women, which are kind of strong physically and but have very white skin with kind of rose-red cheeks, like a little bit like Matryoshka. That everybody knows in the world. So this kind of a woman on this poster with three kids, and I'm quoting the words, "Motherhood needs your heroic deed." Because three kids, of course, for Russia is heroism.
I have one last question for you. We did a version of the story about the allegations about Putin's time in Dresden on our English language website that's generated a lot of comments. And there was a reader in the United States who posted a question. If he was so bad, why didn't she leave him? Divorce was common in Russia, even in the 1980s.
Once again, if you can imagine that 70% of women experience this, then marriage institution in Russia should not exist at all, probably. But this is considered to be, you know, this is not something that women leave their husbands for in Russia, because if she complains that he beats her, and I'm not talking about Lyudmila Putina in particular, but in general, if a woman complains that the husband beats her, then she is to be blamed for the fact that, oh, you allowed this, or maybe you deserved it. So it's a stigma in this society that women cannot overcome, that they're, you know, they're facing this problem at home, but probably if they divorce, they will have more psychological problems and problems in, you know, their social life and relationship with their relatives and families and loved ones. So, you know, women prefer to keep it quiet and, to keep it under the carpet, as we say, and, just to tolerate it or give some resistance, but within the family as well, at home, because there are other statistics that shows that almost up to 15,000 women in Russia are in prison for very violent crime, including murders of their husbands. So those are the women that were pushed into the corner and tried to resist and were desperate and committed those awful crimes in response.
That was our Russian service correspondent Irina Lagunina talking to Daisy Sindelar. For more on the fresh allegations about Putin's time in Dresden, visit our website at rferl.org. And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Your cheating heart will make you but sleep won't come. The whole